G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. It's so good to be back with you, back on terra firma, after having flitted around the world, bouncing about like some deranged psychedelic woodpecker hither and thither. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Austin, New York, Paris, London, Singapore, Perth, Brisbane, Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney. And here we are. And I thought I'd share with you some of the experiences from that trip, some of my thoughts about the Douglas Murray tour, and some of where I've ended up about Israel, Palestine, Gaza, and the rest of the schmozzle that is planet Earth circa 2024. If you're new to the show or new to the subscription, welcome. We've had a big uptick in listeners. It's interesting because when I announced my departure from the public broadcaster in October, the following month, November, we doubled our Substack subscribers as everyone went, ooh, what's Josh going to do? Maybe we'll check out this independent malarkey. And then in December, our Substack following doubled again, which I was so grateful for, so grateful that people jumped in quickly and reassured me, essentially, that there was viability financially and a replacement, essentially, for my income at the public broadcaster. And then it, just now, in the past like 3 weeks or so, we've had another 20% increase, which in absolute terms is probably maybe even larger than the previous increases because, well, you understand percentages, surely. Do I need to go into basic maths here? Hopefully not. So thank you. It's an enormous vote of confidence. It makes me feel like we can take measures to expand this, expand the YouTube channel, take some more audacious risks. And if you've been on the fence about subscribing, please do so. It's just a way of signaling to us that we're on the right track. Douglas Murray, what a fascinating person. What a peculiar little man. And I say that with the greatest affection, Douglas. It's really one thing that struck me hanging out with him is he's, as well as being scrupulously polite and extremely intelligent, he's very funny. He's very funny. He's a lovely person to have dinner with. Like, he's a raconteur. He's got all these, it's almost like, yeah, even though he's not old, he feels like he's been around, he feels like he should be 110 years old. You feel like you're talking to Peter O'Toole or something. And, you know, he's got all these stories that he shouldn't really have about having dinner with so-and-so, and, you know, oh, when I was at, it's almost like, when I was at Cannes in 1924, and you're like, excuse me, wait, what, who? But he's a great regaler of tales, and so it's very difficult, actually, to sustain one's opposition to his political points of view, not just because he's so articulate and they're so clearly thought out, but because you sort of don't want to be a dick to him, you know, you don't want to throw him under the bus. Nonetheless, I tried, at least in a professional context, I tried to push back, especially on the Israel stuff, because while we were touring, literally while we were on the road, there were a couple of things that happened that I think call into question his lockstep opinion with, well, his lockstep position, I suppose, with the Israeli government. The first was that the far-right finance minister, Smotrich in Israel. Is that the bloke's name? I think so. Announced 2,500 acres of West Bank land to be earmarked for Jewish settlements, territory for settlements. He said, and I quote, this is quoting from Smotrich, "Even as there are those at home and abroad who seek to cast doubt on our right to both Israel and to Judea and Samaria," which is what sort of biblical Jews call the West Bank, "we are advancing settlement." So in other words, the Israeli government is literally saying from the river to the sea. They're saying that Israel rightly possesses all of the land, including what is internationally recognized as being Palestinian land and the basis for a future Palestinian state. I mean, talk about not reading the room. Talk about making zero attempt to try to win over or placate people around the world who are conflicted about what Israel is doing. Talk about steamrolling ahead. Jesus. And the second thing that happened while Douglas Murray and I were on the road arguing about Israel and Gaza is that the highest ranking American Jewish politician in history, longtime ally of Netanyahu, the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Chuck Schumer, gave a bombshell speech saying that Israel should hold elections and that Bibi Netanyahu has his time is up, essentially. This is a person who has so much credibility with Israel, whose bona fides are so unquestionable, that he actually split with his own Democratic president, Barack Obama, over the Iran deal and sided with Netanyahu and Israel in opposing the nuclear deal with Iran when Obama came up with that. There is no way that anyone can question Chuck Schumer as an ally of Israel. And he gave this speech saying, and again, I quote, "Netanyahu has shown zero interest in doing the courageous and visionary work required to pave the way for peace, even before this current conflict. He won't engage responsibly in discussions for a day-after plan for Gaza." So my big difference with Douglas Murray, and I hope it would have come out if you'd attended all seven of our sessions together, of our events in Australia, but since nobody presumably did fly around the country with us, this is what I'm doing here, is trying to give you a little breakdown of my reflections having attended all seven, although I only partially attended one or two because I had a very bad head cold, so my body was there, but my brain perhaps wasn't. My point would be, even set aside the interests of the Gazans, set aside the interests of Palestinians, set aside the question of whether or not Israel is behaving abominably or is guilty of war crimes, right? You can debate that. I suppose, you know, the Douglas Murrays of the world will always be able to say, it's a war, Hamas started the war, bad things happen in wartime, I'm sorry. What about the long-term interests of Israel? What about the idea that for Israel to thrive over the next 75 years, 100 years, it's going to be necessary for it to address the long-term interests of Palestinians? What about the question of whether or not it's a good idea to create an arc of allies stretching from, and this is basically the Biden strategy, which I think is a good one, an arc of allies stretching from India up through the Arab Gulf states, through the North African states, and into the European Union and NATO, all of which are allied against Iran and Russia and to some extent China. That is going to be the basis for a future world order, perhaps in an environment in which America is not dependable as the sole superpower to enforce a Pax Americana. And that to do that, to maintain that alliance, you need to have a lot of very different governments all on the same page. And the Arab states and countries like India and even some countries in Europe are not going to buy in if one of those member states is a shitty little pariah that insists on doing everything it can to antagonize and shit upon the people whom it's occupying, right? Israel has to be part of the community of nations. Now, I understand that to some extent there's a bit of hypocrisy here because, as Douglas Murray said on one of our evenings, it's a bit rich to say, oh, we don't want Israel to be a pariah state, and then to do everything you can to try to make Israel a pariah state, and then say, gee, well, it's a big shame that you became a pariah state after we made you do so. Nonetheless, it would be nice to see the current Israeli politicians have incentives to think about Israel's reputation in 50, 80, 100 years rather than their own expedient political interests in order to avoid court cases and cling to power as long as they can. As I said to Douglas a number of times, if October 7th had happened in a climate in which Israel had made clear its commitment to Palestinian statehood, to a demilitarized Palestinian state, eventually, would radical anti-Zionists have less international support than they do? And Douglas's answer, on a couple of occasions, staggered me. He said, no, I don't think that radical anti-Zionists would have any more or less international sympathy, regardless of what Israel does. Now, in one respect, that's a very pro-Israel position, right? Because it's basically saying Israel is blameless. Israel has no culpability for the fact that so many people hate it. On the other hand, it's deeply depressing because it sort of implies that there's nothing that Israel can do that will resolve the situation. It makes Israel a pawn. It makes Israel powerless. It basically says, Israel can brutalize, but Israel cannot win over. Israel can destroy hearts and minds, but Israel cannot elevate hearts and minds. Israel cannot be anyone's friend. There's nothing that Israel can do. You just have to choose you're either with us or against us. You're either on the side of Israeli civilization or the barbarism of the Arab street. And that's the only choice. I mean, I find that untenable. It's also just psychologically unrealistic. It's patently true that there are a lot of people in the world who are like Chuck Schumer and Josh Sepps, who are winnable by a moderate Israeli government that made overtures to Palestinian self-determination and who are completely alienated by a corrupt little hack like Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel's long-term interests depend on having allies, and having allies depends on looking like, at least looking like, you're doing something about a two-state solution. The existence of a process in itself is an asset. Douglas would keep saying to me when I said this, but the process...
To hear the rest of this conversation, go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com/listen, and you will get your own personal premium podcast feed with at least 3 extra episodes of the podcast every month and heaps of extra stuff, including the remainder right now of the fabulous conversation you've just been hearing. If it was worth listening to this much of, don't rob yourself of the rest. Pull out your phone right now and search for Uncomfortable Conversations on Substack.